Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Have you ever lost anything? And you looked everywhere for it, and you were just sure that you just had it. It was just a little bit ago, and yet it somehow is not to be found. And how frustrated we get when we look and we look and we look, and it's very difficult. And we know that anxious feeling of missing whatever it is we were looking for. What if you lose something and you don't even know it's gone? It's not there. In fact, if somebody told you it was missing, you would argue with them. I'm not missing that. Why? I'm fully aware. I know what I'm doing. I know where it is. And then they proceed to show you that you're missing whatever it is. And you would be shocked. Well, how can this be? You know, I was totally unaware. Well, there is something that some people miss, and they don't even know that they're missing. In fact, if you told them that they're missing this, they would likely argue with you. In fact, many may have already done so. Today, I want to speak with the title, The Ten Commandments in the New Testament. The Ten Commandments in the New Testament. We've all come across people that said, well, the Ten Commandments are done away with. Those don't apply anymore. But, of course, that isn't in our belief system, that where we follow the Bible. In fact, we sang hymn 181 today, United We Stand. And take a look at the verses, particularly the verses 2 and 3, and it's very clear. In fact, all the verses will have a reference to it, following the holy commands of God. And so we have that in our understanding of the Bible because it says it very clearly. And how could we lose that? And yet somehow people have lost the understanding that the Ten Commandments still apply. And they say, well, that is an Old Testament thing. So today I want to go through the Ten Commandments and go point by point to give you the tools so that you can show how those commandments that are listed in Exodus 20, where they show up. And of course, there are more than what I'm going to give you, but I'm going to give you enough tools so that you can explain to someone who's lost the Ten Commandments how to find them in the New Testament, how to reinforce them. So first of all, let's turn to Exodus 20 in verse 1. In Exodus 20 in verse 1, of course, this is a listing of the Ten Commandments. We can find another listing in Deuteronomy 5. But in Exodus 20 verse 1, there's a listing of all the commandments. And the first commandment we come to in verse 1 through 3, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. Seems pretty clear. And yet, if the Ten Commandments are done away, well, then people would want to replace the true God with other gods. And indeed, they do so. They've put a lot of things in place of the true God. A lot of things they put away where they spend their time with, or they'll worship false gods. But let's take a look then in Matthew 4 in verse 10. In Matthew 4 in verse 10. And we're going to see where this is in the New Testament. In Matthew 4:10, then Jesus said to him, now this is at a time when Christ is speaking to Satan. And if we go back up to the beginning of chapter 4, Matthew 4, Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness and tempted by the devil. Verse 2, when he had fasted 40 days and 40 nights, afterward he was hungry. Understatement of the year. When the tempter came, he said, if you're the Son of God, command these stones become bread. But he answered and said, and this is where Jesus says, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Well, is not the Old Testament the word that proceeds from the mouth of God? So Christ is reiterating this. And the devil took him up into the holy city, set him on a pedestal, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it's written, he shall give you his angels charge over you, and in their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Of course, that's a reference in Psalm 91, verse 12. And so don't don't be surprised if people who do not believe in God or don't worship God can quote Scripture. Satan is doing it right here and throwing it in Jesus' face. Never had the Scriptures thrown in your face to try to make them mean something that they did not. And in verse 7, Matthew 4, verse 7, and Jesus said, "It's written again, you shall not tempt the Lord your God." Verse 8, "And again the devil took him up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory." And verse 9, "And he said to him, all these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me." Verse 10, "And Jesus said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." What did we just read in Exodus 20? It was, "You shall have no other gods before me," placing God as a priority. If we go to the second commandment, in Exodus 20, verse 4, we might want to put a little marker in Exodus 20. In Exodus 20, verse 4, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them nor serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing mercy to thousands to those who love me and keep my commandments." So we have here a bold statement that says, don't make representations of God. Don't put up carvings or likenesses, any likeness, where you are, that you will set up to worship. And so we see idols around the world. Had an opportunity, this was in 2005, to the World's Fair in Nagoya, Japan. And at the World's Fair, we visited many different buildings and booths of many different countries. And these many of these countries had, interestingly, their cultural idols and their religious idols there. And you found the thin Buddhas from India, and you found the heavy Buddhas from Southeast Asia. Each of them were representing Buddha in their culture. And you find then four-armed goddesses of from various Southeast Asian cultures, or you found those that were made of stone, or we visited many Shinto and Buddhist temples, and you found depictions of serpents. In fact, the serpents that were, and the dragons that had golden scales, and the water coming out of the mouth that you had to wash your hands in before, ceremonially, before going into those temples. Really quite an experience to be able to see that up close, or to go on a path around, in particular, the Golden Temple, I believe it's in Kyoto, the ancient capital of Japan, and they had stone idols that people would throw coins to, sort of like a wishing well, throwing the coins at, I guess, you know. Was really remarkable. There were little knit hats that people would put on them, feed them bowls of rice and rice wine, and cups of that before them. And yet we see, then we had an opportunity to visit the cathedrals in Europe. Phenomenal, phenomenal cathedrals, hundreds of feet high, all erected without cranes. And all of these details and the gargoyles that were on them and various likenesses around them, all these carved images that somehow made them feel good about their worship circumstance. In Exodus 20, it says, just don't do that. Keep away from those kinds of carved images. Let's look to 1 John in chapter 5, in verse 21. In 1 John 5, 21, and so let's see what we find. And if we take a look here, starting in verse 19, "We know that we are of God, and the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one," reference to Satan. Verse 20, "We know that the Son of God has come and given us an understanding that we may know him who is true, and we are in him who is true, in his Son, Jesus Christ. This is the true God and eternal life. So it sounds like the first commandment. This is the true God. Then we go to verse 22. Little children, meaning young children in the faith, people, those all of us who are children, just learning about our Father. It says, little children, keep yourselves from idols. Don't put things that are in the way, false worship. So we have this second commandment reiterated, understood when John wrote this book, 1 John. We can also take a look in Acts 17. In Acts 17, verse 29. Because it's amazing, sometimes you'll drive down the road and you'll see depictions on churches. Depictions are images of who they purport to say is an image of Jesus Christ. In Acts 17, verse 29, well, if we back up a little bit, from verse 23, Paul is writing and says, I was passing through and considered the objects of your worship. So there were objects, a variety of idols or statues or worship centers to a variety of gods. And what does he say? I've even found an altar with this inscription to the unknown God. So it was an altar. It wasn't a statue. It wasn't an idol per se. They were just making sure that there's something there. Let's hedge our bets a little bit. And we'll bet on one that we just didn't know about. And Paul goes on then to describe that particular who the unknown God is. But in verse 29, Paul goes on to describe our relationship to that God. And he says, therefore, verse 29, 17, 29, therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising. What do you suppose Paul was looking at when he spoke these words? I suspect it was gold or silver or stone shaped by art or man's devising. When he looked at it, says that that's because we're the offspring of God. That's not what we look to, is a God like that. It's really the character of God. So since we are the offspring of God, we're not the offspring of this gold statue or this other false God. So we have this reiteration then of the second commandment, says don't make those carved images or likenesses. In Exodus 20, verse 7, we have the third commandment. In Exodus 20 and verse 7. I may spend a little bit more time on this one. In Exodus 20, verse 7, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. We have to ask ourselves, who do we represent? When we are at work for our employer, we are there to represent our employer. When we are at a family reunion, we represent our branch of the family. Whether it's a wedding or a funeral or a reunion or whatever it is. Oh, you're from the Jones side. No, you're from the Smith side of the family and so forth. Well, who do we represent? Do we represent our relationship with God? Do we take the name of God in vain just by how we represent God? Let's take a look at 1 Timothy in chapter 6 in verse 1. In 1 Timothy chapter 6 in verse 1. Let as many bondservants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor, so that the name of God and his doctrine may not be blasphemed. Well, what is this bondservant thing? I'm free to make my own choices, right? I'm not a bondservant or a slave to anybody, right? I mean, isn't that what we say to ourselves? I am my own person. And yet, here we read that at first in Acts that we're the offspring of God, and then in 1 Timothy, Paul writes, those who are bondservants under a master, they should treat their masters well. Well, I guess I should speak well of my employer and represent. I should be a good representation of them. I should be a good representation of my family. And Paul is saying so that if we are a servant of Jesus Christ, then we should honor God by as his bondservant, so that God and his doctrine may not be, what, blasphemed, spoken ill of inappropriately. Who else is listed in the Bible as a bondservant of Jesus Christ? In Romans 1:1, we start right out. Paul writes, says, Paul, a bondservant of Jesus Christ, identifies himself then as a servant of Christ. So he wanted to honor the name of God. He wrote this again in 2 Corinthians 4:5. For we do not preach ourselves, rather, don't promote just ourselves, but Christ Jesus the Lord, and ourselves your bondservants for Jesus' sake. So again, he's referring to himself as a bondservant, or somebody who is under obligation to represent, be a good representative as a Christian. He repeated that in Galatians 1:10, and I'm going to go through a list. I don't know if you want to look them all up, because I'm going to zip through a number. But again, he wrote to the Galatians, for now, in 1:10, I do now persuade men or God? Do I seek to please men? For if I still pleased men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ. So his message was to preach the gospel that God would have him to preach, and not just preach what would make people feel good. Because sometimes the truth doesn't make people feel good. He writes again in Ephesians 6:5, bondservants, be obedient to those who are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling. In other words, respect those who have to whom you are responsible to. And he says, in sincerity of heart as to Christ. In other words, so you are sincerely representing Christ, so you should sincerely represent your employer or those for whom you are responsible to. And he goes on to say, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as bondservants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, Ephesians 6:6. In Philippians, Paul and Timothy, writing together, bondservants of Jesus Christ, describing themselves now here as bondservants. So this whole concept then, and we can go through a few more examples, is to don't take God's name in vain. We're representing ourselves as servants of God. Colossians 4:12, he refers to one of the members of the congregation, Epaphras, who is one of you, a bondservant of Christ, greets you, labors always fervently for in your prayers. So he's writing to the Colossians, referring to one of you, a bondservant. In other words, projecting that all of them are also bondservants of Jesus Christ. Paul again, writing in Titus 1:1, Paul, a bondservant of God and an apostle of Jesus Christ, according to the faith of God's elect and the acknowledgement of the truth which accords with godliness. He's trying to set this standard high. I have to keep this high standard. If I'm going to represent God, I can't have somebody say, there's a Christian, ha ha, look at him. That's one of those kind of people. But Paul wasn't alone. In James 1:1, how does he start out the book of James? It's James, a bondservant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ. That's how he starts out his letter as well. In other words, I'm a servant to Christianity under Jesus Christ through God the Father. The Apostle Peter similarly writes in 2 Peter 1:1. How does he start this letter? Simon Peter, a bondservant and apostle of Jesus Christ. And goes on to further explain the importance of representing Christ. And as we recently read in Jude, the book of Jude in 1:1, a bondservant of Jesus Christ, and so forth. So you have this whole concept that we are serving a great God. We already, the God has said in the first commandment, there is only one God. Secondly, don't put something else in place of that. And now three, don't use God's name in vain. And of course, I think it was John Locke who said, and I rarely quote secular sources, but I will, I believe it was John Locke who said famously that men's actions are the best exhibitors of their thoughts. Whoa, that was almost scriptural. I probably find one that's parallel somewhere. He probably got it out of the Bible somewhere. I haven't found it yet. I haven't looked. But isn't that the way it is? You can say what you want to say, but what is really in your mind, what's really in your heart, is what do you do? And that is very difficult, as many of us have found out, trying to do what we know to be right. And so Jesus Christ used this relationship of master and servant in his stories as well, when he explained things to people or in his interaction with people. In Matthew 15:27, we have the woman. Let me find it. Matthew 15:27 here. In Matthew 15:22, behold, a woman of Canaan came from that region, cried out to him, meaning Christ, have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely demon-possessed. Well, she's a woman of Canaan. She wasn't of the tribe of Israel. And his disciples came and urged him, saying, send her away, for she cries out after us. Well, she's a problem. Verse 24, and he answered and said, I was not sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Ooh, cold water tossed there. No, this, my focus is on the house of Israel. Look at the wisdom of verse 25. And she came, the woman from Canaan, and worshipped him and saying, Lord, help me. But he answered and said, it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Interestingly, the woman then said, yes, Lord, even the little dogs eat the crumbs which fall from their master's table. So here is one who was responding to the message of Jesus Christ that understood the master-servant relationship and says, I just want crumbs. I'll be happy with the crumbs. And what did Christ say in verse 28? And Jesus answered and said to her, O woman, great is your faith. Let it be to you as you desire. And her daughter was healed from that very hour. Phenomenal. The woman understood about the servant-master relationship, and she was there to serve to be a faithful servant of Jesus Christ, and projected herself accordingly. She was living and not using God's name in vain. She was living it when those who were called weren't responding as well as they could have. Let's take a look in Luke, and take a look in Luke. We'll get the alliteration here. 12:42, Luke 12:42. This is really about a parable about a faithful servant. And Peter's saying, verse 41, Lord, do you speak this parable only to us or to all the people? Interestingly enough, this the previous is the parable. In fact, there were a number of parables here. But in verse 42, then the Lord said, then who then is the faithful and wise steward whom his master will make ruler over his household to give them their portion of food in due season? So we have this concept of somebody is a faithful and wise steward, where somebody, the master, made them a ruler over a delegated part of that, or delegated them a responsibility. If we recall the story of Joseph in Egypt, he was brought out of prison and given a responsibility in Potiphar's house. And he was so responsible that he followed up with that Potiphar gave him control of his entire household, his governor of his household, as it were. And so as a result, he did not want to give cause to bring shame upon him or upon his master or employer, as it were. So when we read Luke 12:42, Christ is speaking of those whom the master will make ruler over a household as being faithful and wise steward. If we follow up on that, in Luke 13:25, Christ uses the example again, and just a page or two over. When the master of the house has risen up and shut the door and begin to stand outside, knock at the door, saying, Lord, Lord, open for us. He will answer and say to you, I do not know you where you are from. Now, this particular one is a different parable. We'll get the right one here. 13:25. If we use God's name in vain, will he acknowledge us? Is really what it amounts to. Saying, will the door be open to us if we just say we are following God, but in fact we do not? So the third commandment is don't take God's name in vain, or he may not recognize us because we did not follow our words or our stated belief system with action. Now let's go to the fourth commandment in Exodus 20 and verse 8. In Exodus 20 and verse 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, your daughter, your male servant, nor your female servant, your cattle, nor your strangers within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and then what? And rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. And you know, people struggle with that, and they say, well, I can see how those other commandments might apply, but this seventh-day rest stuff, I got a real hard time with that one. Let's just pick any seventh day, if at best, or that's just an Old Testament saying. So let's take a look at Hebrews 4. In Hebrews 4, verse 4. And the writer here, I'll get to it. Let's back up a little bit, beginning in verse 4, or in chapter 4. And verse 3, for we who have believed do enter the rest. So he's talking about a future rest. For he has said, I swore in my wrath, they shall not enter my rest, although the works were finished from the foundation of the world. Verse 4, for he has spoken in a certain place of the seventh day in this way, and God rested on the seventh day from all his works. And so God is using this example to say, well, God set this example. He created the heavens and the earth. He created all of that. And he set this example for you that by demonstrating that creation part was done, and now he rested. And if you want the ultimate rest, then you are going to have to be accounted as one of God's if you want to get in on that seventh day rest, and as we have come to understand, that millennial rest. So we have this example. If people didn't keep a Sabbath day, they wouldn't be able to understand the example. But they did understand this example. So it was available to be used. Let's go Hebrews 4 and verse 10. We're right there in Hebrews 4, verse 10. For he who has entered his rest as himself has also ceased from his works as God did from his. Well, if we're of one of God's, we're going to do what God does. We are also going to keep the seventh day Sabbath, which is clearly expressed up in verse 4, and then says, and that's for us too. That's for us too. So the fourth day is remembering the Sabbath day, or fourth commandment. Let's go to the fifth commandment, which is Exodus 20 and verse 12. Exodus 20 and verse 12. Honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long upon the land which the Lord your God is giving you. Well, it's really hard to argue against that one. So even the people that don't like the commandments, they all have a mom and a dad, and usually they like at least one of them. But to be consistent, to demonstrate that, well, actually, we have the phenomenon you may have heard that when people who are in prison, they have the opportunity to send Mother's Day cards. Many of them do. Father's Day cards, they have a hard time finding anybody who wants to send a Father's Day card, which is really a rejection of God the Father. They don't know that, just because their physical father was not a very good representation of God the Father. So then that removes them from that closeness or relationship with Christ. So honoring your father and your mother isn't just a physical thing, it's also a spiritual thing. So let's go to Matthew 19:19, where it's stated explicitly in Matthew 19:19, honor your father and mother. And then it follows up in the same verse, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So throwing a little bonus there, Matthew 19:19. You want that commandment repeated in the New Testament? There it is. And then we followed up with the sixth commandment in Exodus 20:13, you shall not murder. Well, most societies believe this, and they don't point to the Ten Commandments as their source for their belief, because otherwise it would speak to a complete societal breakdown. Do they practice this? No. In the 1900s, which would be the 20th century, perhaps 100 million people were killed by their own government because it was expedient to get rid of them. Those that had those kinds of collectivized central command governments that had dictatorships actually put forth policies that killed, and it's hard to imagine 100 million deaths. But they didn't respect the commandment of do not murder. But most communities do, and they will ostracize in some way, with either capital punishment or estrangement of some sort, for someone who commits murder. Let's take a look at Romans 13:9. In Romans 13:9, and here it lists several commandments are repeated. And here we have the repetition of the commandments. Romans 13:9, for the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there's any other commandment, they're all summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. By doing these things, you're not just loving your neighbor, you're demonstrating it by loving yourself. You don't want anything bad to happen to you. You shouldn't want anything bad to happen to your neighbor. So you have these commandments that are right there. The number six commandment, you shall not murder. Seventh commandment, you shall not commit adultery. Eighth commandment, you shall not steal. Ninth commandment, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. All of those are right there in Romans 13:9. In the seventh commandment, we also find, which we read in Exodus 20:14, you shall not commit adultery. We read in Matthew 19:18, because nowadays, apparently, it's not that big of a deal. The percentage of children born out of wedlock in 1965 was relatively small. Today, we are approaching a tipping point where there are nearly as many children born out of wedlock as there are born into a marriage. And people say, what for? Maybe it's not good for me, and so forth. So what did Christ say about adultery? In fact, we have a real burden in society. If you take a look at the difficulty that society has with regard to compensate, I don't want to use the word compensate, although that's probably what happens, is the amount of public assistance given to children who are born out of wedlock, which is significant. And as those who, in economics, there's a principle that if you subsidize something, you get more of it. And if you tax something, you get less of it. So we tend to subsidize illegitimate children, which are a consequence of adultery. And then we tax families to pay for the, to tax natural families and married couples to pay for the others. The in Matthew 19:18, Christ again reiterated the commandments, and the young ruler said, "What commandments do you mean? Which ones, you know, what do I have to do?" And Christ said, "You shall not murder, not commit adultery, not steal, you shall not bear false witness." He says, "Yeah, yeah, that batch right there. You know those." He didn't have to say them every line item of everything there. Of course, we already mentioned in verse, the eighth commandment in verse Exodus 20, verse 15, "You shall not steal." And we understand in the New Testament, and I didn't put the references, we understand that that extends through other biblical examples. You don't steal not just physical things. You don't steal ideas. You don't steal a person's good name, and so forth. So stealing isn't just things. It extends beyond that. You shouldn't steal someone's words and so forth. The ninth commandment in Exodus 20, verse 16, "You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor." Well, we think that's kind of easy. Perhaps I'll reserve that for a future message, because we often forget those last three words, "against your neighbor," which is an interesting caveat. So we're going to, but my students recently studied about evil King John in the year 1215. Some of you may have heard about the Magna Carta, an early document. And evil King John, even by the writers in that day, was considered a pathological liar. He would tell lies and then believe his own lies, and then rule as an absolute monarch. And the nobles, and he would borrow men's wives and didn't always give them back, or he would borrow their daughters. And he would tax somebody to, he would tax one of the nobles. And when they couldn't pay the taxes, he would seize their property for lack of payment of taxes and seize everything that they owned. One nobleman escaped with his life. His wife and son did not. And so he locked the wife and son up in a tower in London, and he thirsted them to death. But he was so well noted for his lies that the noblemen finally got together on, and I believe it was June of the year 1215, and they got together and had a meeting out in the field in Runnymede outside of London. And 25 noblemen came, fully armed, each with their own army. And as I explained to my students, they came, catered, Kentucky Fried Chicken catered the place with mashed potatoes and gravy and some extra crispy chicken and some coleslaw, and they all sat down at a picnic table. At least that's what all the pictures look like when I see the artist's depiction of the time, where they're all sitting at this big table out in the field somewhere. And they told the king, "You can either sign this document, this Magna Carta, the Great Charter, that says that the king has to follow the law. And you cannot, by hook and crook, deceive people." And a big, long list of things, 63 things, that the king had to follow the law. He couldn't be the accuser and then the judge and then the executioner, all of the same. You had to separate those functions out. And that's where the insistence of those nobles said, "We'll have a jury trial. You can't bring up, the king can't say you're guilty of X, Y, or Z, and here's the false witnesses I'm bringing in to convict you, and now you're convicted, and now I'm going to execute you and take your property." The nobles said, "Who's going to be next?" So they told the king, "You know, you can still be king, but you actually have to follow the law. Even your own law, you have to actually follow it." And the king signed it, claimed it was under duress, fought it for about a year, and died of a respiratory problem. But since then, we've had this Magna Carta, where everybody, this whole concept of following the rule of law. Where does this concept of rule of law come from? What are we reading about here today? The Ten Commandments. What does God expect us to do? Follow the rule of law. We just don't make it up on our own as we go along, like Calvin and Hobbes' cartoon, where they play Calvin ball and Calvin makes all the rules up as he goes along, if you've read the cartoon. And that's what evil King John was doing. So when it says bear false witness against your neighbor, that's a time-honored tradition among tyrants. So that's part of the rules of the game here. And of course, it's spoken of in Romans 13 that says don't bear such false witness. Tenth commandment in Exodus 20, verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. Well, this whole coveting thing is really hard for some people because, you know what, no matter who we are, somebody else always has more than we have. I was listening to a sermon at the congregation in Southern California over 20 years ago, and I remember the pastor said, how many people would like to make 10% more money? Everybody raised their hand. Everybody wants to make 10% more money. And he said, well, bear in mind that those who are on your right or those who are on your left likely already make either 10% more than you or 10% less than you as it is right now. So one must be careful in this regard that you are want something. Even if you had what they had, you wouldn't be satisfied. You'd want what the next person had and the next person had and so forth. So we really have to be careful with the coveting thing. It's not wrong to want to better yourself or to increase yourself. But at the expense of your neighbor, well, there we have a problem. if we take a look at Romans 7:7. In Romans 7:7, Paul writes, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? What does Paul say? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. The law, for I would not have known covetousness except the law had said, you shall not covet. They wouldn't even have an awareness that it was wrong. Which reminds me of my daughters who went to summer camp many years ago. Maybe 10 years ago, and they came away from camp, and I said, well, what's your big takeaway? What did you really learn? You know, you're 16, you went to camp, what did you learn? And they said, well, when you have choices set before you, make the good choice and not the bad choice. Choose life and not the bad choice that leads to death. And I said, well, didn't you already know that? And they said, well, you know, when we go to school, they don't even know that there's a difference between right and wrong. It's just choosing between one thing and another. And what is Paul saying? Had not the law been there, saying you shall not covet, there wasn't even the understanding that that would be wrong. So we have a secular society that doesn't even understand that it's inappropriate or wrong to covet what is somebody else. In fact, they think it's a good thing. That person makes more money? Well, maybe they should share it with the rest of us. Not realizing that they are coveting. Colossians 3:5, Paul continues to write about this issue of the 10th commandment. And he includes it in a list, a very uncomfortable list in Colossians 3:5. Therefore, put to death your members, which are on the earth, fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. So it's tying this back together. Wanting something inappropriately, as was listed in the 10th commandment, that's not yours, that you want, is idolatry. Which then, of course, we look back at an earlier commandment, the second commandment, and that's putting something in place of your relationship with God, which would then violate the third commandment, which means you are not properly representing God. So Paul is saying here, this whole coveting thing is the same as idolatry. You're putting something in the way. Something else is more important than God. And if you're doing that, you're keeping the Sabbath is in vain too, because then you're just doing it for show, whether for yourself or someone else. And how can you honor your father and mother when God is your father, the church is your mother, and you aren't, and you're putting something else in the way? You're putting this coveting, this idolatry that's in the way. How can you honor the one true God when you aren't honoring, when you're letting covetousness get in your way? And then, of course, you're murdering your own reputation before God. You're destroying that. And, of course, and it talks about not stealing here in our eighth commandment. Well, if you're coveting, you may have already stolen it in your mind. How can I have that which is of someone else? And bearing false witness against your neighbor, you don't want to bear false witness against yourself either. Are you pretending to be somebody whom you are not? So really, this 10th commandment really wraps them all together and puts it tightly. So if we want to take a look at the 10 commandments and say, are they repeated in the New Testament? We can take a look through this list and we can say the principles permeate the Bible. They permeate the understanding that we have of God. These commandments are fundamental to understanding the plan of God, so we now have these, we can use these tools. If anybody ever challenges us and say the Ten Commandments are done away, no, they are foundational, and God uses them throughout the Bible to reinforce His plan and for us to use for the betterment of our lives. Mr. Jackson.